standing on the rubble of her home. She cries out for her parents, but the voices are gone. She cannot understand. She's gone.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Remember Palestine with me, Lauren Booth. In today's programme, we will be speaking to a spokesman for the UN Relief and Works Agency on the departure of John Ging, their Director of Operations in Gaza. We will also be exploring a playwright's efforts to look at the impact of restrictions on movement in Gaza and the West Bank. Here's a clip from the radio play, Escape from Gaza.
Please speed the bus. Let me get through the border.
Excuse me. Sorry, I have to...
1 hour before it shuts, my badge on my head like a battering ram. It's like a scene of hell in one of those paintings. 7:10, old people collapse, children howling, animals kicking, filth on the ground. 7:25, police shoving, lashing with sticks. 7:35, people back away, scared of my bags. It's the main gate. 7:41, like a stampeding animal, jostling, trampling, old people, children, God forgive me. 7:44, if I hurl my bags. Yes, my bags are inside. My turn. I made it into no man's land.
Sir, my passport, please. Ahmed Massoud. Massoud, yes. Thank you.
On the bus there. Hurry.
Just half a mile between the gates, I can see the hills of Gaza. Dear God, thank you. Thank you for this. For being here, for my son, for Heather, for Dudo, for preserving my family. Please help Mum to get better. Give her your strength and your peace. Please help the chemo do its job. Give her calm. Open the prison inside me. Let me reach her.
And I'm pleased to be joined now by the author, the award-winning author of Escape from Gaza, writer and director Justin Butcher. Welcome to Remember Palestine.
Thank you.
Do you know what, Justin? I find that really hard to listen to and watch because I've done the no man's land at Rafah Crossing and also at Erez. And it's frightening and dehumanizing. But the writing that you've done is so involved, and yet you've never been to the West Bank or Gaza.
That's right, to my shame. Not yet. Not for want of trying. But, no, I was working with Ahmed Massoud to dramatise his true story of his visit into Gaza in June 2009. Ahmed and I first worked together in January, February, March of that year, creating a stage drama called Go to Gaza, Drink the Sea. This was a sort of immediate response to the Israeli attack on Gaza in December 08, January 09. I, at the time, had felt a sort of visceral response of horror, anger, and a sense of needing to do something in response. And so I, in January of 09, I set about contacting my network and saying to people, look, I have it in mind to create a piece of theatre in response to this attack on Gaza. And to my surprise, there was a sort of overwhelming flood of response from hundreds and hundreds of people, not just offering money and resources, but help of other kinds and moral support. And that was how I was put in touch with Ahmed. Ahmed had a number of letters published in The Guardian at that stage.
And he's a student from Gaza.
Well, that's right. He came to London to complete his degree in English literature. And and then embarked on a PhD in English literature, and now teaches, works at Oxford Brookes University. And he was writing to The Guardian about the experience of seeing your own family under bombardment through the media, you know, and not being able to get through on the phone often. At one point, for example, he was watching Al Jazeera, you know, a broadcast of the conflict in Gaza, and saw his own brother running out of a building, a burning building, with a dead child in his arms. And of course, Ahmed, watching this, was convinced that that was one of his nephews, you know. In fact, as it turned out, it was someone else's child, but so what, in a way?
So how do you make a departure from horrific stories into something creative? Because it's clear that there are 1.5 million real dramas going on right now in Gaza. Well, what's your experience of creative process?
Well, my role has been to help shape and focus and the true stories, really, that Ahmed has shared from his life and the life of his family. In this case, with the excerpt from the play we've just heard, Escape from Gaza, intensely personal story where in the aftermath of the war in Gaza, he discovered that his mother was very ill with colonic cancer. He'd not seen his family for 7 years because of the blockade. He'd since married in London and just found out then in sort of spring of 09 that his wife was pregnant with their first child. So he was presented with this terrible dilemma, desperate to see his family on the one hand and to see his mother, and also to take her provisions and, you know, colostomy bags and things which are, you know, embargoed or totally insufficient in the supply in Gaza, but at the same time, you know, not wanting to leave his wife who was pregnant. And so the play takes this dilemma and follows his journey into Gaza. And my role was as co-writer, I suppose, and as one step remove, you know, to apply the kind of cold iron discipline of dramatic technique, you know, to the story. And there's so much which is true that has to be left on the cutting room floor, you know, because what one is engaged in is telling a story which will actually engage, in this case, a British audience.
So did you have any nervousness about approaching something that, although you felt passionate about, is considered controversial? Did you have any problems getting the radio play, for example, on the BBC, or is the interest there?
The interest is there, definitely. When we first approached the head of BBC Radio Drama, in fact, with this story, I'd just successfully written something else for them, so I was flavour of the month. And I said, look, this is an extraordinary story, you know, true story of Ahmed's journey into Gaza. Pregnant wife in London on the one hand, critically ill mother on the other. You know, it's a wonderful human drama, and these were the terms in which we sold it, set against, you know, this extremely current and painful, you know, true life scenario. And the argument that we made was it's a brilliant way to illustrate the reality of everyday life for Gazan people. Because this guy is half Western and half Gazan, you know, and he's journeying from the West into Gaza. So the audience follow him on that.
And it's fresh, it's renewed the freshness of the horror for him as well. Just quickly, there was something that struck me about Go to Gaza, Drink the Sea. I saw an excerpt of it when there was a pile of shoes. Let's talk about the device that you use there to really capture people's hearts.
Well, we were working with the Scottish artist Jane Frere, who's worked a lot in the West Bank. She, in 2008, created an exhibition for the Edinburgh Art Festival. It's also been to Beirut, called Nakba, Return of the Soul.
Very short on time, sorry.
Thousands and thousands of waxwork figures travelling into exile. So multiples was her thing. And it was working with Jane. She came up with this idea of piles of shoes, you know, painted ashen grey. They were representing the rubble of war-torn Gaza, also representing the identity of the dead. And resonant with, you know, picking up shoes and throwing them at George Bush, piles of shoes outside mosques, this sort of thing.
Well, it definitely worked very much when I saw it. And so Go to Gaza, Drink the Sea. Still about to hopefully go into production again. And your radio play available, Escape from Gaza, on BBC iPlayer.
That's
perhaps.
Right.
Thank
yes.
you very much for joining us. It's been said that one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. So it's important to remember that amongst the tragedy of the failed peace process in the Middle East, real families are struggling to cope with daily life. Earlier this month, RP's Jasmine Dewa went to the screening of One Family in Gaza. Here's her report.
The bright glow outside a cinema in South London was reflected by a warmth in people's hearts as they arrived to hear the story of One Family in Gaza. Dozens of viewers crammed together to watch a screening which told how parents endured the loss of their son during the Gaza War in 2008. The audience came to hear how the family holds on to hope for their other children, despite a devastated home and destroyed livelihood. They have been given a global voice through film by director Jen Marlowe, who met them during a trip to Gaza and stayed with them for 2 weeks.
First of all, thank you so much for being here. This is really an amazing turnout with such short notice.
I wanted to spend time with them, which I did, and the filming was almost more secondary.
The story is incredibly powerful. It is one family literally describing what happened during the days of the Israeli assault.
When you do see a family like the Awaja family and you see that they have been able to hold on to some grain of hope and of resilience and of strength, and of course, again, they are not alone in that. There are many other Gazans who are still nurturing that, certainly nurturing their own humanity and expressing it. But the level of trauma is also very overwhelming, and I felt that.
The audience was moved by Jen's experiences, which she shared following the screening. But the mood took a different turn after one man admitted he worked for an Israeli company and opposed boycotting goods from Israel.
My 7-year-old child.
It's important that we create an atmosphere in this space where divergent opinions and divergent views can be heard with respect.
Ultimately, the event was enriched by the diversity it drew in, with an atmosphere of openness and hope for a better future for Gaza.
The power to change that situation lies in Cairo, in the cotton mills of Cairo, in Tunis, in Amman, in Damascus, where there is a growing working class.
The film has also been shown in Ramallah, Haifa, Jenin refugee camp, and Ireland, and is set to screen in the USA and Australia. Proceeds from the screening go to the Awaja family, making a difference to one and perhaps many more families in Gaza.
And I'm joined now via satellite from Jerusalem by UNRWA spokesman Christopher Guinness. UNRWA is the key agency, of course, that has provided aid and protection to the majority of Palestinian refugees for the past half a century. Christopher, welcome to Remember Palestine.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to talk a little bit today about the fact that John Ging, the representative in Gaza for 5 years, has just left your agency. He's going to be a great loss to Gaza and to UNRWA as a whole, isn't he?
Absolutely. John's departure, although we're pleased about his promotion, he's going to be number 3 in the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in New York, dealing with global disasters, catastrophes and all sorts of things. So we're delighted for John because he will bring his extraordinarily principled approach, his charismatic personality, to bear on all the public advocacy he does. But make no mistake about it, he has built a team in Gaza very much in his own image. He leaves behind a very competent and capable staff, highly motivated and committed, and they will carry on with all the programs, with all of the Ging philosophy. So be not mistaken, things will carry on its business very much as usual with UNRWA, despite John's departure.
Is there a low morale, though, in Gaza? Because I know that UNRWA's building programs are still being stalled by restrictions on entry and exit via Israel. Is that correct?
Well, yes, you're right in what you say about the restrictions, but you were actually asking about morale, and the answer to that is absolutely not. I mean, one of John Ging's extraordinary legacies is that he's left behind a group of people, both Palestinian staff and international staff, who remain utterly energised and committed. They are working under the most difficult circumstances. This blockade is making our human development work in Gaza very, very problematic. We teach 206,000 children. We run over 200 schools. We need to build 100 schools, and yet the Israelis are forcing us to use this tiny bottleneck of a crossing point known as Kerem Shalom. So it's fine for the quartet to meet and to talk about new projects and for new projects to be announced, but how are we going to get building materials for 100 schools, which is what we need in Gaza, through this tiny little bottleneck? We need to lift the blockade properly. We need to open all the crossings into Gaza, and only then can we say that the collective punishment of 1.5 million people has ended. You know, a collective punishment is a bit like being pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. Well, international law's like that. You're either violating it or you're not. You're either committing an act of collective punishment or you're not. So let's stop the collective punishment of 1.5 million people in Gaza. They deserve and demand nothing less than the rest of humanity demands, their dignity, to be allowed to live a dignified, prosperous, stable future. And with all of the sorts of unrest that we're seeing in the Arab world, I think it's important to ask the question, what about some stability for Gaza? We're seeing ordinary people in the Middle East saying, we want to end the poverty, we want to end the political isolation. Well, that's what we need to think of in terms of Gaza. Let's end the poverty, let's lift the blockade, and let's end this political isolation, because there's no doubt that Gaza needs to come in from the cold. Gaza is willing to come in from the cold, but we just need the political will to make that happen.
I wonder how significant the changes in Egypt are then. Do they bring hope to UNRWA about the Rafah crossing, or is it slowing things down because nothing's getting through, even through the tunnels at the moment?
Well, I mean, I think in the short term, it's clear that the Egyptian authorities have got many other things on their mind. And I think that might explain why there have been problems on the Egyptian-Gaza border. But I think that in the long term, we have to say that the example that people are showing in Egypt, the very fact that they are demanding an end to decades of extreme poverty in some parts of Egypt, and the fact that they're saying, we want to be politically relevant in a proper democracy, I think that's highly significant for Gaza. And I think in the long run, I think that watching democratic values, if indeed that's what we're seeing, informing the political debate in the Arab world, then I think in the long term, that surely can only be good for Gaza and indeed for the Palestinians more widely.
Just quickly, Mr. Gunness, we need to move to the West Bank. Barbara Shenstone, Director of Operations there, has now gone as well. And of course, the recent Bedouin community in Dakeika being demolished again by the IDF. What's the situation there for not just the Bedouins, but the people of the West Bank?
I'm really glad you asked that, because often Gaza overshadows the West Bank. But in one sense, Gaza is something of a sideshow, because the state, the Palestinian state, is going to happen very largely in the West Bank. Area C, as it's called, where these demolitions are going on, East Jerusalem, where you see the permit system, you see demolitions, you see eviction orders. It's very much centrally where the Palestinian state is going to happen. So if you want the peace process to succeed, then in a sense, dealing with the West Bank is just as urgent as dealing with Gaza. And so, yes, you're right. What's going on there? Well, we're seeing evictions rising. Palestinians in both Area C and East Jerusalem have to get permission from the Israeli authorities to build. So if you have a few more children and you want to build an extension to your house, you have to get permission. That permission is being routinely and systematically denied. So Palestinians have no choice but to build without permission. And there are 60,000 people today in East Jerusalem who we fear are living in buildings, in homes, where there are extensions that should be, which have been done, but which have been done without permission because the Israeli authorities simply are not giving permission. Now, if they really do start enforcing these demolition orders, it could be really quite catastrophic. Tens of thousands of people stand to lose their homes. And of course, these evictions and the permit system and all of the regime around the settlements and settlement expansion is very much aimed at one ethnic group, the Palestinians. So it's discriminatory. We have to ask ourselves what kind of discrimination we're talking about, because, you know, discrimination lies at the heart of this policy, which is being rigorously implemented by the Israeli authorities against the Palestinians. And that has massive, massive significance for the peace process itself. When I see pictures on the TV...
Jerusalem Al-Quds, we're out of time, but thank you very much for that analysis. And our best wishes to John King of UNRWA for in his promotion.
I'll pass it on. Thank you very much indeed.
Now, if you want to leave your comments about what's been discussed on today's Remember Palestine, here's how to get in touch.
Now, don't forget, you can text the Remember Palestine team with your comments about the issues raised in today's programme on +44 78 00 000 377. You can also email us your comments, any interesting stories about Palestine, or even send us a 30-second message through your webcam to our email, rp@presstv.co.uk. And don't forget, you can always add your comments on our Facebook wall and even send any pictures, songs or videos you would like us to feature. We look forward to hearing from you.
Let's have a look at what's been happening in Palestine now with a review of the latest news from the region.
According to figures by a human rights organisation in Israel, demolitions by Israel of Palestinian homes in the West Bank tripled in 2010. Yearly figures published by B'Tselem show that Israel demolished 86 homes across the West Bank in 2010, compared with 28 a year earlier. Last year's house demolitions left 472 people homeless, almost half of them children. This month, news outlets had leaked a 2009 transcript showing that the Palestinian Authority intentionally delayed a vote by the UN Human Rights Council on supporting the Goldstone Report on human rights violations during the Gaza War in 2008-2009. Initially, the UN Human Rights Council planned to vote to endorse the Goldstone Report in October of 2009. However, the newly leaked document shows that the Palestinian Authority called for the vote to be delayed to 2010 at the urging of the United States in order to encourage Israel to return to the negotiating table. Cyprus announced last week in a letter handed to the Palestinian president that it recognizes a Palestinian state in the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. In turn, this makes Cyprus the first European Union member country that officially recognizes the Palestinian right to statehood. The letter also stated that Cyprus will not recognise any Israeli changes to the geography and demography of the occupied Palestinian territories, including in occupied East Jerusalem. This has followed on from the recent recognition by 9 South American countries of the Palestinian right to statehood. Residents of Bethlehem have launched a campaign to have the city placed on the World Heritage List in order to protect and preserve the area's landmarks. This would officially mark the city as belonging to all the peoples of the world, irrespective of the territory in which it is located. 20 sites were identified across Palestine, including the site of renewed excavations in Jericho, Ramallah, and the historic city centres of Hebron and Nablus. Although the sites enjoy recognition by the local council, appointed by the World Heritage Secretariat, none of the sites are on the list.
That's all we have time for today, but I leave you with these words from one of the most enlightened founding fathers of America, Benjamin Franklin. They that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. That's all from Remember Palestine. Until next time, goodbye.